Tonight, another look at what is my favorite academic discipline, one that I do not participate in, but which I much, whose products I much enjoy, namely history. Three historians are with us tonight. By introduction and by full definition, they are James Craycraft, who is professor of history at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and a leading student of Russian history. He used to work a good deal on the Soviet Union, but basically his field is Russian history from earlier centuries. Ethan Shagan is professor of history at Northwestern University, and he specializes in the politics and religion of Reformation-era England. That means we go to the Tudors and somewhat beyond, or from the Tudors up to the Glorious Revolution, I should think. Suzanne Kaufman is professor of history at Loyola University, and she specializes in modern European history, particularly some interesting events in 19th century France. We'll talk about the special fields that each of our people, each of our guests tonight pursues. But first, let me put to you the general question, and I can offer you as an epigram, or epigraph, really, for our program, one of my favorite quotations from, you will recognize it, from Leopold von Ranke, who really established sort of the scientific approach, or propagandized the scientific approach to history. And you remember, he says, the task of the historian is, in the original German, alles erzählen, wie es eigentlich gewesen war. Tell everything the way it really happened. James Craycraft, is that possible?
Well, not in the literal sense that you might interpret that, even if you refine your interpretation of the German you just gave, to mean something more like a representation as best you can of the evidence that you've read. In Ranke's case, it was always state documents and state archives, and it was always political history. So right away we see the limitations on his formula, his approach. Political history, while still practiced and still probably the most important form of history sold today in the United States, commercial popular history, political biographies, is by no means the only kind of history practiced in the academy.
Yeah, and powerful men doing important things and going and starting interesting wars and signing new kinds of peace treaties and reorganizing the map, that's not the only level of history, is it?
Certainly not, as your other two guests, and indeed myself, though I have majored, as it were, in the history of Russia at the time of Peter the Great, and he is a dead white male for sure, and he was a ruler. My own approach to his reign, the significance of his period, has been one of cultural history, that is to argue that what happened of greatest historical significance at his time was a cultural revolution. And your other panelists tonight, indeed, have not focused in any way in or on political history.
Well, our other panelists tonight deal one with England and the other with France. So let me offer you two further little epigraphs to head our inquiry tonight. One Englishman said, history is little more than the register of the crimes, follies, and misfortunes of mankind. That, of course, is Edward Gibbon. And one Frenchman said, history is a myth that men agree to believe. Do you know, Suzanne, who that was?
I don't. I'd like to think it's someone like Michelet, but I'm not sure.
Well, it's even more important than Michelet. It's Napoleon.
Ah.
Is history merely a myth that we all agree to believe?
Well, it's not a myth, but it is a series of subjective pronouncements. And I think what's most out of date or less in touch with modern historiography about von Ranke's statement is that we are as interested in understanding people's subjective experiences of what happened as we are in understanding the actual events that happened, and that the historian's craft is very much about interpreting those subjectivities for our own rather than simply transparently indicating the sort of factual details of the past.
What about the Gibbon statement? He's really stressing evil as the main course of the flow of events.
Well, I
selfishness, viciousness, vulgarity, and self-seeking in the worst sense is what history is really about.
Well, clearly, for historians who want to sell books, we all know that's true. That
it also sells a lot of books.
Right, that the viciousness and evil of the past certainly sells books, but it's not necessarily all that history is, of course. I would sort of agree with what Ethan was saying, that what historians are probably most interested in doing now is trying to understand what stories become compelling to us, and how certain ideas of what happened in the past become the truth that we all want to believe. So one question I would pose is, why is it that we want to tell stories that focus on the viciousness, the evil, the vanity of man? Why are those stories the ones that become so compelling to us?
What's the answer to your own question? We are always fascinated with evil more than we are with goodness, I think.
Well, I wouldn't say that's necessarily the case, since my own work is focused on apparitions of the Virgin Mary in 19th century France and the development of sacred sites. I'd say that we are always interested in things that seem extraordinary and remarkable. What I think the interest, or outrageous as well. What's interesting is the way in which what comes to be constituted as extraordinary or remarkable has changed over time. For von Ranke, what was extraordinary was, you know, Frederick the Great, and his ability to lead armies or such. Today, we would constitute what is the extraordinary not merely in the hands of a few important leaders, but in, say, in the 1970s or 1980s, it would be the collective actions of peasants or workers.
It's also the case that we live in an era, as did Gibbon, in which cultural criticism and the act of critiquing the excesses of our own society is, for want of a better word, hip. It's sort of what we do in academia, and it's what our students like. And so concentrating on evil, concentrating on the failures of the past, allows us to accent the failures of the present. Whereas in the intervening period, very much in the 19th century, in Franca's era, history was, to the extent that it did study atrocities and evil, it was about learning from them to have arrived at the glorious age that is the present.
Yes, and I would add that among the many turns history writing has taken in the last 20 or 30 years, the quantitative turn, the anthropological turn, the linguistic turn, there now is perhaps, and now I get to your question, Milton, a moral turn. That is to say, I think one of the reasons people read history, and indeed write history, is seeking lessons, or morals, as we used to call them, about how not to behave, or how to behave, or what happens if one behaves in a certain way, and what happens if one does not.
But I offer you yet another quotation, this from memory. Hegel, one of the fathers, in a way, of historiography, as well, or a philosophy of history, says someplace, the only thing people learn from history is that we learn nothing from history.
Well, I think that's in Hegel's sweeping universe of historical, or historiosophy, as we'd call it, historical philosophy, that may well be true. At a level so abstract and remote, it approaches pure sound, I must say. But I think for us, with our feet on the ground, and good historians are the kind of people that I think really do have their feet on the ground. They have to, the kind of tedious work that we do in order to produce our history, are interested in these kinds of, and again, I think increasingly today we're interested in, our readers, our students, and we ourselves, I think, are increasingly interested in the moral dimension of history, a sort of using history somehow to help us find our moorings again, perhaps?
Let me give you something from modern history that you and I remember, and I think our two younger guests have heard about it, but probably weren't really fully focused on it at the time. That is the student revolt in this country in 1969, 1970, and so on. Mm-hmm. By then, I was certainly teaching. I was, in fact, I had come to the University of Chicago. Mm-hmm. And much happened that is not really told in the usual histories of that time. There were lots of students who were apathetic, there were lots of students who were opposed, lots of faculty were very concerned about this kind of breakdown in regularity and discipline within the universities, but instead just that great surge of popular student feeling is what is stressed by the modern historians who've dealt with that. Which brings up, I think this is my last quotation for a while, this from Goethe, no less, who says, and it's a very important point, not all that is presented to us as history has really happened. And what really happened did not actually happen the way it is presented to us. Moreover, what really happened is only a small part of all that happened. Mm-hmm. Everything in history remains uncertain, the largest events as well as the smallest occurrence. There's a great deal that's left out.
Well, you move from quoting a philosopher, Hegel, to a poet. I mean, God bless us, how can we get anywhere with that sort of
that's the clearest
authority.
The clearest failing of history, and it's an inevitable failing, is that it can't deal with everything that happened. Well, I think of Simon Schama's book about the French Revolution,
yes.
Citizens, isn't
yes.
that what he called
mm-hmm.
it?
Yes.
And what he did, what made that so interesting, is he dug up a great deal of stuff from the popular prints of that time and gave us events and happenings in and around Paris and elsewhere in the Vendée,
yeah.
Which don't even show up in Michelet's great history of the French Revolution.
Mm. Well, I think that was sort of precisely the point that Ethan was bringing up earlier, that now I think there's we've changed a lot from von Ranke's age. We now accept that all history is subjective.
Mm-hmm.
And partial. Yeah. I mean, even someone like Ferdinand Braudel, who claimed to be writing, Ferdinand Braudel, for those out there who don't know, was a very important early French historian, father in some ways of the Annales school. He claimed to be writing literally a total history. And he attempted to do it by literally trying to map out the physical history, demography, economic, social history, and then only at the top of his pyramid was political history. Even in his attempt to cover all three tiers, he said, well, I know that I will be rewritten.
But the basic
and I'm
thought,
glad for it.
The basic thought was history from the bottom up, wasn't it?
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. One of the
ordinary
things,
people rather than those who strut on the stage of political power.
Well, or the material base.
The material base.
Itself, yeah.
Yeah, the geography of the various provinces of France and so on.
Right. And, and of course, once you switch the focus from what he called the fast time of political history to the very slow time of material culture and demography, you're not so much talking about change over time anymore.
Well, with all of this in mind, and as we pause for some commercials, the assignment I now offer to you, and if you will accept it, and I'm sure you will, is to talk about your own periods, the periods you've been working in, and tell us how one can reconstruct from the materials you've closely examined in scholarly terms what happened crucially in Russia in the 17th and early 18th century as it turned towards Europe, in England at the time of the Tudors and beyond as the Reformation occurred in England as it was also occurring in Northern Europe, and so that society was transformed. And in 19th century France, as a peasant girl, Bernadette Soubirous had a vision which has had great consequence down to the present day. We'll look at the separate work of James Craycraft, Ethan Shagan, and Suzanne Kaufman directly after this. And we return to three historians, all from local universities, and all working very different parts of the total terrain. Suzanne Kaufman is essentially focused on the social history of 19th century France. Ethan Shagan is focused upon the religious and royal history of England from during the time of the Reformation, starting with the Tudors in the 16th century and on to, about 200 years later, I would guess. James Craycraft has, for a somewhat longer career, been much focused on the history of Russia. And, Jim, let's go to Russia, and let's go to the man on whom you've done a number of books, Peter the Great. What was so great about him?
Well, I am still not sure. I say he was great because of the revolution he led, and I say the revolution he led was essentially a cultural revolution, and the net effect of that cultural revolution was to bring medieval Muscovy, isolated, backward, Muscovy into the European mainstream.
He's a modernizer.
Indeed, a modernizer, and you can't account for Russia's role in the modern history of the 18th, 19th century as a great power and a great part of European civilization without looking at Peter the Great.
Was he called Peter the Great probably for various reasons, was one of them his height. He was just about the tallest man in Europe, was he not at the time?
Yes, I suppose he was very close to it. He certainly excited comment wherever he went in Europe. He was 6'7". We know that because we have a lot of his clothes and other paraphernalia, furniture, a ton of stuff.
One
of
almost the things big enough to play for the Lakers if he had chosen.
Right. Well, at a time when a tall person was 5'7", his 5'9", his great opponent, Charles XII of Sweden, military genius, it said it was a pathological need to kill people, others would say, was the last great, quotes, last great king of Sweden was 5'9". And so Peter was, as it was said, a full head taller than tall people.
What are Peter's dates?
1672, born, 89 on the throne, 1725 he died.
From 89 to...
1725.
To 25, so, that's a long reign.
Yeah,
to be
36
sure.
years, yeah. More or less 36 years.
You speak of his period as having featured what is called, I suppose you didn't coin this term, the Petrine Revolution, the Revolution of Peter.
Well, I did actually coin it in English. Petrovsky Revolution in Russian, or Petrovsky Переворот, was a term used very judiciously and carefully by the great Solovyov in the 19th century and really dropped thereafter. And I think I can claim to have introduced it or reintroduced it into historiographical discourse more recently. But with careful definition of what I mean by a cultural revolution, there's no question, and when Solovyov was talking about Peter's revolution, he was talking about revolution in the old political sense, a revolution in Russia's standing in Europe, from this obscure backwater to a major power, and a revolution in the ruler's position within Russia, from a hereditary sacerdotal monarch to an absolute.
Among the many things he did in terms of material accomplishment, he more or less built St. Petersburg. Did he name it for himself or what?
Well, it was named after his patron saint, St. Peter, and indeed he did build it, and indeed it survives as the single biggest and most obvious memorial to Peter and his revolution. I mean, there's no great city in the modern world that's more closely associated with its founder, not even Washington, D.C., than is Petersburg with Peter the Great. There's any number of things one can say about him, but he was called the Great towards the end of his own reign by his own people. By his own people, I mean the way politicians say, my people. His entourage, who conferred on him this title in recognition of his victory over Sweden in the Northern War. So Russia displaced Sweden as the great power in the North and then became the great power in the East of Europe as well. So within a generation, St. Petersburg was the capital of Eastern Europe as well as Northern Europe. So he's called the Great for that reason. I think, Milt, you're right, he should be called the Great for his height. I call him the Great because he led this semi-consciously, gradually, gropingly, understanding it himself, this revolution in Russia's...
There's a great film that I saw years ago. Was it Eisenstein who did it or somebody else? About Peter and his taming the boyars and so on.
In Eisenstein, he did one on Ivan the Terrible. There was a wonderful film based on the novel by Alexei Tolstoy, nephew of the great Tolstoy, a novel which won the Stalin Prize. which doesn't necessarily recommend it to lovers of literature, but it did signify the importance of this novel and Peter's rehabilitation under Stalin as a great patriotic hero. So he was given this, Alexei Tolstoy was given the Stalin Prize for this novel on the eve of World War I, the German, World War II, and the German invasion. So, and it was called Young Peter, or The Youth of Peter the Great, or indeed was called Young Russia, the film version. That was a brilliant film of the 80s.
It's interesting that we start with that because it raises yet another basic question in the philosophy of history or the theory of history, and that is whether history is, as some have defined it, nothing but the record of the doings of great and important men, that is, a great historical actors, or whether social forces rather account for the flow and the detail of history. And the easy way to handle that, one easy way to play that question, is to do the counterfactual. You just kill off earlier than he really died that crucial figure. If Peter had died of some dread disease when he was 18 years old, how different would Russia have turned out?
Well, I mean, it is a counterfactual, which historians are loath to...
They resist it, but they always play
resist
the game.
With it, but we do thought experiments, as we can call it. It would be unimaginably different, the course of modern history and the course of Russian history, had this guy not lived, did what he did, interacted the way he interacted, had these passions, desires, people he dealt with. But I stress throughout that he never, I mean, you know, page one of my most recent book on the subject, he did not act alone, and no leader by definition, ever does. And it's the quality of his leadership that he gets people to follow him and follow him to do very difficult things and over a long period of time. And change on such a scale is, of course, very difficult. To change from these customary ways of thinking and doing things to wholly new ways of thinking and doing things. And it was Peter the Great who founded a navy in Russia, the incredible thought that this nation of landlubbers should, by within a quarter century, have a first-rated naval fleet, a new government. I mean, one can go on about the things that he accomplished that I sum up in the term cultural revolution, new ways of seeing, new ways of visualizing, new ways of thinking, new ways of speaking. The modern Russian language dates to his time, that is the language in which literature and science are conceptualized and discussed.
Here's a theoretician of history who handles the question that I've just raised, the role of the great historical actor in history, who says, men make their own history, but they do not make it just as they please. They do not make it under circumstances chosen by themselves, but under circumstances directly found, given, and transmitted from the past.
Mm-hmm.
Who is that?
I don't know, but I wish your listeners could see you, Milt, shuffling through your papers and finding these quotations.
There's a lovely sheaf of quotations right here. That's Karl Marx.
Yes.
Who really has to account for the presence of certain great figures acting in history and transforming history, but he argues only because the time is ready for it.
Well, what Marx recognized that I think we also recognize, but which I think the general public thinking about history often forgets, is that leaders in the pre-modern world, and even to some extent in the modern world, didn't have the capacity to carry through their actions to fruition without consent. We have this sort of fantasy of absolutism and of the great monarchs of the pre-modern world ruling with an iron fist, yelling off with their heads. The reality is these are people who, for the most part, had no effective bureaucracies, had no effective means for collecting taxes, did not have standing armies or police forces. Everything that they did had to be done through the acquisition of the consent of their people.
Who is it in the French Revolution who gets off the line, tell me where the crowd is going, I'm their leader and must take them there?
Well, what Ethan is saying is true of the pre-modern. Now, Peter the Great happens to come in, Louis XIV, any number of other rulers' periods, precisely at that transition from the pre-modern to the modern, when precisely bureaucracies are formed to implement modern armies and the infrastructures to support them, tax systems, etc., and the subject becomes increasingly a citizen and taxpayer.
Yet we can't avoid the presence of certain historical actors who, if they had not been there, all the world would have turned very differently. My favorite example of that is, just imagine Hitler as a soldier at the front in World War I. Ein Frontsoldat, as he bragged he was. Suppose he had been shot down and killed in World War I.
Yeah.
This is undoubtedly true.
All of the rest of history would have been different.
And
individual actors have tremendous impact. It's undoubtedly true. But it's also the case that even in a society so regimented as Hitler's Germany or Stalin's Russia, the so-called secret police, they went home to their families at the end of the night and became citizens again. The idea of a police state is somehow based on the idea that the people who make it run are not the same people who live in it. And that's not the case. I think every political society is built on an infrastructure of political support one way or another. That doesn't mean that there's not an overwhelming quantity of
resistance. Even Baron Scarpia had nieces and nephews that he was very fond of.
I would also just add a point, sort of getting at what Marx was saying, is not only are individuals sort of subject to their material economic circumstances, the things around them, that their very ideas do not just spring fully formed from their heads alone. That people like Hitler, of course, couldn't have had the ideas he had without Mussolini. And that these ideas are also in the air, and they're being shaped by a multiple of sort of what we might call discourses.
Couldn't have had his ideas without Houston Chamberlain and the Count de Gobineau.
So that even
racist theorists who gave the program for anti-Semitism of the modern form.
And so a long, rich tradition of German anti-Semitism.
Right, and so even the most outrageous and horrific characters who clearly steer history in directions are the product themselves of larger forces.
We are overdue for some commercials. which is a measure of the fact that I'm so fascinated by what you're saying. But we will pause right now, and then I think we'll go to 19th century France and look at Bernadette Soubirous and all that followed thereupon, followed upon her visions, and how it happened. That is the work of Suzanne Kaufman, as given in her most recent book, Lourdes and the Making of Commercial Culture in Modern France. We return directly to James Craig Kraft, Ethan Shagan, and Suzanne Kaufman after these words. We are talking about the craft of history with three practitioners of the craft from three of the universities in Chicago. They are James Craig Kraft. Craig Kraft practices the craft of history, and he is professor of history at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Ethan Shagan is professor of history at Northwestern, and Suzanne Kaufman at Loyola University. And I had the wrong title for your newest book, Suzanne. I guess what I had, what I read was the provisional one, but the final title, and I've just been looking at the book itself, is Consuming Visions, Mass Culture and the Lourdes Shrine, published by Cornell University Press, is
yes.
that right?
It's hot off the press, so it's okay. That's
hot off the Cornell
The new and
press.
Recent title.
Well, what about it? We know that the central figure is Bernadette Soubirous, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us something about her and what happened.
In 1858, Bernadette Soubirous, who was out gathering wood for her family with her sister and a friend, was off by what is a garbage heap, and she got separated from her friend and her sister and saw what she claims to be a vision of the Virgin Mary. This was the first of 18 visions of the Virgin Mary that very quickly caught not just the attention of her village, but literally the attention of all of France. By her final vision, there were thousands of spectators who came to see her in ecstasy as she was having her visions of the Virgin Mary. Of course, only Bernadette Soubirous saw the Virgin Mary, but thousands of people witnessed her digging up the ground, discovering a spring of water, and doing all sorts of things that in fact, I should clarify, she never said that it was the Virgin Mary. She referred to the vision as the beautiful lady. It was those in the village around her who interpreted what was going on as a divine act, as her communication with the Virgin Mary. Pointing out, once again, that it's not necessarily individuals who make history, but the communities that they are a part of as well.
Which is the focus of your research, one assumes.
My own research, I mean, I should say there have been many really important and interesting histories of Lourdes written. My own interest is in not so much the history of Bernadette, although she's fascinating, but in the development of the shrine itself. And in particular, I'm interested in the commercialization of Catholic pilgrimage, the way in which Lourdes became not just a holy site, but a holy site that was intimately connected to modern forms of commerce, modern forms of technology. And one of the things I argue in my book is that it is, in fact, the commercialized nature of the worship that makes it such, that made the site so important and popular for Catholic believers.
Well, so what stands out in the story of that commercialization process?
I think a couple of things stand out. One is that the church itself had a complicated relationship to the commercialization of the shrine, as I would say the church has a much longer history of complicated feelings towards commercialization. On the one hand, it certainly used all the means out there, the mass press, the modern railroad, the mass production of mass production techniques to spread word of the site. On the other hand, it also felt that it was tainted by commercialism. One of the things my book looks at is the sort of complicated relationship between religion and commerce, the way, and I'm particularly interested in the ways in which popular believers can in many ways experience a more profound religious connection through commercialized objects. That's what I find particularly interesting. So in my
own, commercialized did Lourdes become? How commercialized is it down to this time?
Well, if you were to visit Lourdes today, I would say some devout believers go and they're quite shocked that in order to reach the grotto where mm-hmm. Bernadette saw the Virgin Mary, you have to walk down two major streets that probably have, I don't know, maybe 500 piety shops that sell, 500 on each street. There are more hotels. Lourdes has the in France, it is the city with the second, it's the second largest center for hotel action and tourism. So I guess I can say that Lourdes is in some ways a religious Disneyland. And I don't say that with any disrespect. I say it with a sense of respect that it is a place where it is a destination. And because of that, it has become a thoroughly commercialized site.
Of course, a crucial question that anyone with any religious conviction or concern would want to raise, and so I will raise it for him or her, is, but what about all the cures that have been achieved there and that are recorded? I've never been to Lourdes, though I've been around that part of France. I've never actually been to Lourdes. But I've been, for example, to the shrine of Saint-Anne-de-Beaupré up in Quebec, which is a similar place, based also on a vision of that sort. The church is lined with crutches, and there are wheelchairs strewn around the grounds, all of which were, quote, left there by people who had their miracle cures. They walked in on crutches or rolled in wheelchairs and left on their own feet. Similar cures for all sorts of other afflictions. And there's much evidence of that sort of thing. At least the evidence is part of the commercialization, is it not?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, you're absolutely right that part and parcel of the Lourdes experience is not just Bernadette's visions, but her discovery of a spring of water that immediately became a site of healing. So Lourdes is of course, known for the hundreds of thousands of people who claim to be cured, although the church itself only recognizes 66 people as authenticated miracles.
Over all these years.
There are only 66 authenticated miracles, but they do recognize that many other people have been cured. They just haven't gone through the very rigorous process that the church has set up to authenticate a miracle and distinguish it
from
the church.
What's the most striking or impressive cure of all the ones, of all the 66?
Probably one of the most famous was a cure that didn't happen at Lourdes, but happened at what was a replica shrine of Lourdes in Belgium. And it was by a man named Pierre de Ruder, who was, the cure is spectacular for a couple of reasons. His leg was broken, literally in two pieces. He had suffered for years and years with it being broken. It was well documented. And not going to Lourdes, but a replica shrine in a teeny village outside of Ghent, he was suddenly and completely cured. So that in itself was striking. The church, the other thing that made it striking was after he died, Catholic doctors did an autopsy of his leg and found that the leg was completely cured. So this is probably seen as one of the most important and thoroughly authenticated miracles. And I would add that it's in many ways seen as even more amazing because it happened to a man, because almost all of the miracles that have been authenticated, and even those that haven't, have occurred to women, and there have been many accusations that these cures were hysteria. But in many ways, Pierre de Ruder's cure was seen as beyond hysteria, in part because it was an organic broken leg, and because he was a man and supposed to be somewhat untainted by a, quote, woman's affliction.
One thinks inevitably of people who populate late-night television in this country. They buy the time. They are miracle healers, usually of the evangelical Protestant persuasion, who lay on hands and say, walk, heal, or you have arthritis, do you? We'll cure your arthritis, or you can't hear. The shouts in the ear, and the person says, I hear now because Jesus has cured me. Peter Popoff is one such who does this. Many others have. Is there a relation between that sort of stuff, which looks very spurious to me, and what happens at a place like Lourdes?
There's certainly, I mean, Protestant faith healing and Catholic beliefs in miraculous healing are certainly both tied to understandings of Jesus as a healer in the Old Testament. So there are certainly ties there. But I think the actual process of miraculous healing at Lourdes is a very different experience. And it's one that the church very quickly brought under the reign of a more traditionally Orthodox Catholic healing experience. Almost all the cures at Lourdes happen in the course of the Blessed Sacrament being passed around. Either people are literally cured in the presence of the Blessed Sacrament or through a process of ritual bathing in the water. So it has nothing to do with the laying on of hands. There's not a miracle maker. Mm-hmm. It is really through prayer to the Virgin Mary to intercede on her behalf for Jesus. And so, and in this sense, it's very different than Protestant faith.
What role did the cult of Lourdes or the fact of Lourdes play in the larger life of France?
I think that's a very important question. France, as an extremely secular nation, a nation that once the Third Republic came into being, sought a ruthless process of secularizing and separating church and state, in many ways has tried not to, I think, acknowledge the importance of Lourdes. But I would say that Lourdes is an integral part of the modern history of France. One of the striking things about Lourdes is that its own development parallels the development of modern France, in the sense that Lourdes wouldn't have happened without the development of the railway, wouldn't have happened without the development of modern politics. In the sense, Lourdes' own popularity was in part a response by the Catholic Church to try and galvanize people to the site in a response to anti-clerical politics.
What questions would historians want to put to a fellow historian who's worked on this material? If we were sitting in a seminar and Craycraft and Shagan were listening, they would now ask what?
What would I ask? I would ask the degree to which... Let me start with the first question is, why was the historian attracted to this subject? And how did she deal with the evidence, the kind of evidence that the subject inevitably led to? And I'm talking about dealt with it not only in the strictly historiographical analytical sense, but dealt with it as a person, as a witness to this happening in the past.
I mean, those are wonderful questions. I would say that in one respect, I became interested in the topic for reasons I haven't even sort of alluded to, which was I was actually interested in women's history. And I was interested in Lourdes because it seemed to be a place where women's religious experience seemed to be a challenge to the type of modern politics of France. With that assumption, I went into the project and in some ways came out with a very different analysis once I had sort of looked through the material. Lourdes was a site of female religiosity in the sense that it was women who went to the shrine, it was very much a female symbolic experience. The imagery was all about sort of female religious figures. But one thing I found was, rather than seeing it as somehow an attempt to flee the modern world, my own analysis now points to the way in which Lourdes became a place where women could encounter the modern world.
Huh.
It became a space where they actually, through a safe environment, one they felt familiar with, they could encounter the train. They could encounter modern commercial culture. They could go to wax museums, which was the precursor to the modern movies. They could read newspapers about miracles. They could take trips and be in an environment that was in many ways a true cosmopolitan city.
So there was in our buzzword of the day, an empowerment going on, an empowering is happening here in some way or other with the
I think that there was
pilgrims.
I think that for devout Catholic women who chose to go to Lourdes, it was a place where there was a type of empowerment which I found interesting, and even more curious, a way in which they found access to the modern world in ways that we don't normally think can happen.
Ethan Shagan, what question stirs in your mind as you hear this stuff?
Well, the biggest question that's stirring in my mind is about what made Lourdes so different and so much more successful than all the other thousands of miracle shrines scattered throughout Europe. There are wonderful stories from the 17th century, for instance, in Bavaria, where dozens and dozens of shrines that were patronized by the Counter-Reformation Bavarian state demonstrated. There's lists of the miracles that took place there, and on one list there are 16,000 miracles in the 17th century, and yet those shrines have completely dropped out of our knowledge and imagination. So what is it about Lourdes that makes it such a success in the modern age?
And I should say continual success, because there are still about 5 million people that go to Lourdes every year. I'd say that in many ways, you're quite right that at the time of Lord itself, there were other French sites that were very popular. I think that the church made a very calculated effort to choose to make Lord a site of not just local pilgrimage, but mass pilgrimage. And it did it by literally creating what was known as a national pilgrimage to Lord, an event that was highly publicized, highly orchestrated, and partly out of luck. One of the reasons that Lord got chosen for the national pilgrimage was quite simply because there was a railway line that went to the site, whereas another popular site in the Alps, known as La Salette, was too hard to get to. So in a sense, I would say fortuitous events like the railway and calculated decisions and Bernadette's own visions, which were not threatening to the church hierarchy, which could easily fit Orthodox beliefs, which in fact seemed to confirm one of the most important doctrines that the Pope had recently declared, the doctrine of Immaculate Conception.
You remember Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. Mm-hmm. It goes back to the 14th century.
Mm-hmm.
The very last lines of the prologue are, "Su Canterbury they wende, the holy blissful martyr for to seca, that him hath holpen, one that they were seca." They wend their way to Canterbury to seek the holy martyr to seek, who helped them when they were sick.
Mm-hmm.
So there's miracle cures going on there as well, but a very different site based on a very different event, namely the murder of Thomas a Becket.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that that's partly what I meant is Bernadette's visions of the time were in some ways open-ended, but very benign. And I think that helps to explain why hundreds of thousands of women went to the site and found it a place of therapeutic healing, in a sense, a type of recuperation from a world that seemed overwhelming.
The French are given to that. That's what they went to Vichy for, as a matter of fact, without any religious significance as such.
I think that's very true.
Yeah. There's no doubt French dimensions, but there are these other major shrines, Guadalupe,
to be sure, around the world.
Right. I mean, Lord is special, but not totally unusual.
Right.
We are due for some commercials, and when we return, we will go to Tudor England and beyond, looking at the work of Ethan Shagan. That to follow directly after these words. In about 15 minutes or thereabouts, we will be going to the phones and to the email. And so we're opening the lines right now for phone calls. The number, as ever, is 591-7200, 591-7200, for anything you want to ask of our three guests concerning the periods in which they specialize, or more broadly, concerning the art, the craft, or can it sometimes be a, quote, science of history? 591-7200. If you'd rather reach us by email, particularly if you're listening over the Internet at some great distance, the email address is extension 720 at tribune.com. Extension 720 as one word at tribune, tribune.com, or 591-7200. If you don't mind waiting a bit, get your calls in directly. We'll be with you fairly soon. But let's go, indeed, to 16th century England. Henry VIII is another figure who looms large, surely, on the historical record.
Indeed. Not quite as tall as Peter the Great, but as wide as he was tall by the end of his life. And indeed, someone who had a singular importance in English history. Henry VIII's break from Rome and separation and creation of the Church of England has long been hailed as a seminal event, not only in religious and political history, but in the foundation of the British Empire, in economic history, through the dissolution of the monasteries, and in practically every field of human endeavor.
He really shook the place up.
He did. He did, and one gets the sense, reading what he wrote, that he very much enjoyed shaking the place up. I think that may be why I'm so attracted to him.
He enjoyed also dispatching some of his wives to the headman's block.
He did, although I'm not convinced he enjoyed that quite as much.
How many of his wives did he have executed? Two or three?
Executed.
Anne
is
Boleyn.
Only two. Anne Boleyn and...
Jane Seymour?
No, Jane Seymour died of natural causes in childbirth.
Yeah.
And then it was the succeeding... Oh, can I remember who the succeeding wife was?
Grey?
No, Grey was the final wife who outlived him.
Yeah, who tamed him.
I can't can't remember.
We're all blocking on Henry VIII.
Yes, it certainly wasn't the Spanish lady.
But the interesting event there, among many, is, of course, the break from the Catholic Church. Is one to see that as essentially just an eccentricity undertaken by Henry VIII as a way of justifying his divorce and his remarriage, or is it one of those more or less historically inevitable things just because Northern Europe was breaking away from the Catholic Church, as had happened earlier at Wittenberg and so on?
I don't think there's anything historically inevitable about it, no. I think the interesting question is how it is that such a sordid affair as the king's divorce mm-hmm. translated into a Protestant Reformation. Henry VIII, after all, was not a Protestant, was never a Protestant, had written tracts against Martin Luther himself, and when he died, had masses said for his soul in the traditional Catholic fashion. He believed throughout his life that he, in fact, was the good Catholic, and that it was the Pope who had broken from true Catholic
tradition.
He had a title,
Defender of the Faith.
Defender of the Faith, exactly, a title that was given to him as a result of his writing a book called the Assertio Septem Sacramentorum, the Assertion of the Seven Sacraments against Martin Luther. He also got the title Defender of the Faith because he was upset that his two great rivals in Europe, Charles V, Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, and Francis I of France, was called the Most Christian King. So he needed a good title from the Pope as well.
By the time his daughter is on the throne, Elizabeth, England hates Catholics and sees almost everything that goes wrong as due to Catholic plots.
That's right. That's right. And it's an extraordinary transition. I wouldn't say that that's the case when Elizabeth takes the throne. It's certainly the case that by the time of Elizabeth's death in 1603...
Or by the time of the gunpowder plot and so on.
Yeah, no, gunpowder plot being immediately after Elizabeth dies, the Spanish Armada in 1588 mm-hmm. is clearly a very important event in shaping this traditional English anti-popery.
So how does one account for all of this?
In my own opinion, and in my own research, the way you try to account for this is to understand how ordinary English people would have perceived of the Reformation. Unlike in virtually every other European context where the Reformation is promulgated and defined as a theological event, as a representation of salvation through faith, in England the Reformation is promulgated as an act of state. It's required of people. It is put forward through a series of acts of parliamentary legislation. And common people in European history had a great deal of experience in what to do when the government started promulgating new programs. What they did is they negotiated. If the government proposed a new tax, well, people said, we'll pay some of the tax, but maybe not all of the tax. If the government wanted to raise troops in a given locality, the common people were perfectly capable of negotiating, okay, well, we'll give you these troops, but we need a new road. And if we imagine the Reformation in England as an act of state that's susceptible to that sort of negotiation, what we find is ordinary people participating in the Reformation and taking on the language of Protestantism, the priorities of Protestantism, before they actually become Protestants. So it's a process that I would want to separate from a strict sense of national conversion. This is not like St. Paul on the road to Damascus with a flash of light and the scales fall from their eyes and suddenly people realize. It's a process not only of negotiation, but of political, economic, social expediency by which people's consciences shift over time because in a wide variety of ways, it's in their best interest to do so.
And as they change religion, what else do they change? What else is part of the transformation worked by Henry and those around him?
Perhaps the most important thing is the dissolution of the monasteries in England. Mm-hmm. Dissolution of the monasteries not only instantly took something like 8,000 men of the cloth out of their profession, it also transferred essentially the second largest landowner in England, second only to the king. All of that land and wealth was suddenly, instantly transferred to the laity. And what that meant was that all of the gentlemen and noblemen of England, those people who sat in Parliament, suddenly established an extraordinary power base they had never had before. And I think it's not a stretch to trace the growing power of the laity, and especially of Parliament, in the 17th century directly to that event.
And doesn't it also guarantee a very loyal new aristocracy?
Well, that's exactly right. People who took part in the dissolution of the monasteries, who gained that land and wealth, were literally invested in Protestantism. And that was true, by the way, even at the level of the populace. There are wonderful accounts that we have of ordinary people literally breaking into dissolved monasteries, stealing the stained glass, stealing the ceiling beams, and using them to refit their houses.
Isn't that all memorialized in the nursery rhyme, Little Jack Horner Sat in the Corner?
I didn't know that.
Put in his thumb, pulled out a plum, said, "What a good boy am I." I'm told that goes right back to
the
nobles and the others who enriched themselves out of the dissolution of the monasteries, that this really was an enormous transfer of wealth and distribution of wealth.
You know, when you tell this story, which I'd never really thought about it in the way you said it, of course made me think of, say, what the French revolutionaries did, which was, of course, sell off all the church lands right away and, in effect, enrich the peasantry and gained many, many allies.
And they started a new religion as a vehicle of state.
Without a doubt. And one could argue that, of course, the Catholic Church never recovered from this, and this certainly did lead to a path of secularization. But in France, there still was this intense reaction. Everyone was happy to have the land sold off. It was a smart way to raise money. It got peasants land. But then people got mad that there weren't priests around to help bury the dead, to help do all sorts of things that they wanted. And in a sense, that did create a very potent counter-revolutionary trend. But that doesn't seem to be the case in England.
Interestingly, it is true that by the beginning of Elizabeth's reign, and even earlier, even Protestants are lamenting in some ways the effects of the destruction of the monasteries, if not the destruction itself. Many Protestants in Henry VIII's reign, and I say again, Henry was not himself a Protestant, but he used Protestants for these programs, and many Protestants wanted the proceeds from the dissolution to be used for poor relief, to be used for education, and for a variety of social services. Henry VIII refused to do that. It's been suggested in a series of articles that may have been part of what led to Anne Boleyn's downfall, is that she, who was herself a Protestant, was pushing against Henry's minister, Thomas Cromwell, to have the monasteries used for poor relief.
The interaction between religion, particularly as it changes, and social order as it changes, and the economy as it changes, is an utter fascination wherever you look. I've been much interested, just as a teacher, teaching a course in the psychology of religion, as I have on and off over the years, very interested in the Weberian analysis of Protestantism in relation to the rise of Protestantism in relation to the rise of capitalism. The Weberian thesis that Protestantism in North Germany and so on sort of generated capitalism has by now been put aside, I know, in historical discourse. Still, it's a very challenging hypothesis, and it relates to so many other things. I've been quite fascinated, and even tried to do a little bit of writing on Hasidism and the Sabbatean messianism that preceded the rise of Hasidism as a great strange event in Jewish history, the only time they ever yielded to a messianic claimant, and the catastrophic consequences that had, and the ultimate reorganization of European Jewry in the European Pale around a new invigorated form of Judaism, a simplified form of Judaism, namely Hasidism, which comes down to us to the present day. You can see these folks in Rogers Park today. There's nothing more fascinating to me, I think, than religion in history.
Yes, you can take religion. I could certainly do it in the Russian case. We could do it in the American case. I think Judaism offers a fascinating example because of its long continuous history of how religion evolves, of how religion interacts with society and culture. It isn't one or the other, you know, chicken and the egg.
Judaism, like all religions, is really constantly changing, but lots of the participants don't know it.
Yes, and some religious folk assert the impermanence, and others assert the permanence.
These are
religious views. These are views of, but as historians, we see this constant. I would stress the interaction because it's very difficult to say at a given time. I don't know my colleagues here what they would say on this very point, but it is ultimately very difficult to interpret religious documents in ultimately other than a religious way.
Here's a question that I, as a social psychologist, love to put to historians. It's terribly simple, terribly basic. Societies don't hold constant. Everything is always changing. As I said only recently, the French don't really say plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. It's plus ça change, plus ça change. The more it changes, the more it goes on changing. Why is that? Why isn't there stability in history?
Because there's motion, that's why. As we sit here, your heart is beating, as is mine. If it weren't, we'd be dead. And as we are alive, we are moving.
But why don't certain societies...
Aristotle defined...
But why don't societies, good ones, workable ones, stabilize and work? And, but and stay what they are for 400 or 500 years.
But there are stable elements. Institutional history is a branch of history that a lot of historians interest themselves in, and that's precisely to get at those elements in societies, not permanent forever, but stable elements. They're called institutions. The politicians come and go, the institutions remain.
This brings back something that Suzanne was saying before, quoting from Ferdinand Braudel, who envisioned actually three lengths of history to study. He imagined the short term, what he called l'histoire éventuelle, event history, which was the mere superstructure, what you and I do in our lives. And then he imagined the long durée, as he called it, the long term, which was thousands of years, geological time, climatic change, population change. And then he imagined the middle term, which was the life of a politician, the life of a parliament, the sorts of changes that a single person can see in a lifetime. And he made clear that change is constant. But it depends very much on the scale on which you look. If you're looking at, for instance, the ways in which women's experiences, say, changed in European history, you can look for many hundreds of years and find that most women's lives throughout most of Europe involved pretty much, you know, working hard, getting married, having children, living and dying.
Men do. I mean, the majority of men lead lives of nasty, brutish, and short.
I say women only because of a fascinating book called The Prospect Before Her, A History of Women in Early Modern Europe, which has tried very hard to make this point in a sort of Braudelian manner. And yet, if you looked at the lives of any one of those women, what you'd find is extraordinary change over time.
The other ways in which, though, I think historians now are increasingly fascinated with change over time is... Even in the world of sort of a seemingly unchanging person, the lives of non-elite women over time, what we do find is that while their everyday life might seem, for hundreds of years, women are doing the same thing, the very notions of what it means to be a woman, a femininity itself, or masculinity, or all sorts of sort of identities, are actually very subject to change. And what it means to be a woman in the medieval period is not the same thing as it is in the 19th century, even though those women might be subject to a set of activities that are fairly similar. But the very notion of identity seems to be as changeable.
We have not yet even adverted to American history, but I'm sure all three of you have a good deal that you could say to illuminate aspects of American history or the problems that kind of preoccupy you with regard to the history of this country. We're pausing right now for some commercials, and then we're going to be getting on to the phones directly. A strong invitation to all who are listening, if anyone wants to join us, now's the time to make your move. The number 5917200 for any question you've got about any period in history, and certainly questions in response to the particular areas of historical inquiry that have been, if only briefly, described tonight by our three guests. 5917200. And if there are any working historians, graduate students, or otherwise listening, we'd be delighted to hear from you as well. 591-7200, the lines are open. We look forward to your calls. Now is the time to get them in. If you're listening into Kuala Lumpur or up early in London or a little bit later in the day in Baghdad and listening to us on the Internet and want to join us via email, the email address is extension720@tribune.com. Extension 720 as one word, at Tribune, TRIBUNE.com, or 591-7200. We hope to go directly to your calls after this. And we've got some email in front of us, but not yet phone calls. So if you want to join us, do move quickly to get to the phones. 312, the area code, then 591-7200. For any question you want to raise for three working historians, 591-7200. And for email, extension 720@tribune.com. The question of Henry's wives is partly solved by this communication from a listener in Rockford, who says there is a mnemonic device that is used in England to remember the fate of Henry VIII's wives. It goes, divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. But he doesn't identify which is which. Mm-hmm. Now, you ought to be able to work this out.
Yeah, no, it's actually no mystery. Nor is it my own ignorance. It's just the hour, I'm afraid, that's keeping me from remembering right at the
moment. Divorced is the first wife.
Yes, it's Catherine of Aragon.
Then comes Anne Boleyn.
Anne Boleyn, who was
beheaded.
And then Jane Seymour.
Who died. And then the next one was...
And the next one is Anne of Cleves.
Who was divorced.
And the next one is the one who's, for some reason, has just left my brain.
It hasn't left mine. I can recall it through the infinite mists of long-lost memory. It's Catherine Howard.
It is Catherine Howard.
Though I confess, actually, Maggie Burt whispered it in my ear just a moment ago. And the last one who survived...
Is Catherine Parr.
591-7200 is our number. We'll go now to the phones. 591-7200. You are on the air. Good evening.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Hi, I wanted to talk about the 1948 partition of Jerusalem and maybe get your opinion about what would have happened if the UN did not vote to give the Zionists their own state.
Well, now we come to a very different area of history. And another one of those great what-ifs. What if Harry Truman had not been strongly influenced by his former partner in the haberdashery in Kansas City, his Jewish partner,
right,
who supposedly helped to persuade Harry Truman to go along with the establishment of the Zionist state?
Yeah, I just read a book called Old Jerusalem. I forget the author, some French writer. It was a fantastic book, and it brought up that point. There was many, many interesting events and interactions between different people that brought the state about.
Mm-hmm.
But I was thinking that, you know, if the UN didn't vote to partition it, do you think that over the next 50 to 100 years, the Zionists would have had a state in a much more, you know, less tumultuous fashion? The state would, I mean, the Zionists were buying up land, building businesses, buying apartments, you know, they were building their own state.
Sure. The Jewish community was a large presence in old Palestine, absolutely.
It seems as though if the UN had not done that, and of course the Zionists were very well.
Well, you asked the question, but like Pilate, you have not yet stayed for an answer. Let's get some answers.
Well, I would say I don't have a good answer to the particulars of the partition in 1948. What I would say is that there are any number of different occasions on which the Western European powers decided to intervene in Palestinian and Jewish affairs. The Balfour Amendment in England in 1916, which initially set the idea of a Jewish state as a part of long-term English policy, was itself a way of trying to gain Jewish support in World War I, mostly to do with trying to prevent the Russians from pulling out of the war.
Isn't it true that somebody who had strong influence upon the formation of the Balfour Declaration was, in fact, Chaim Weizmann,
yes,
who became later the first president of Israel?
Yeah, that's right. That's absolutely right.
And the question could well be, had his vision of Israel prevailed, what will we call it, Israel as the Switzerland of the Middle East, right, rather than Israel as the Serbia of the Middle East?
Well, I think the Serbia came along partly because of the way they were given the state. I think it caused a lot more animosity among the conflicting people over there, and there were plenty of Jews and Palestinians that got along, and I know there was radical Zionists that rubbed a lot of people wrong in the early days, but there was plenty of them that were just coexisting, and the community was growing, and they were obviously better financially backed, and they were more intelligent than most people over there, and I just think that over the years, if the UN hadn't stuck its nose in and a few influential people over here didn't pressure the UN, things would have, they would have...
Well, there are all the great ifs in history. A great if that I enjoy tremendously is, what if the French had reacted to the militarization of the Rhineland in 1930, was it 35 or 36, when Hitler marched a few troops into the Rhineland, violating the Versailles Treaty. If they had put him down, it is commonly argued, Nazism would have collapsed and World War II would never have happened.
That's certainly the argument. The funny thing is, these things always look a lot different with hindsight than they do at the time.
Yeah.
You know, there are so many cases in which, for instance, in modern politics, we say, don't appease, look at Hitler in the Rhineland. Of course, there are about a million other times in history when, rather than going to war, European powers chose to negotiate, and the result was not World War II, but rather peace.
But it
can be very hard without hindsight.
Then you don't call it appeasement, you call it something
right,
else.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Or there's that old principle that we all subscribe to, at least implicitly, that the truth is in the details. That is to say, rather than embrace philosophically some deterministic view of historical development, it had to happen this way, it was inevitable it happened this way, or the opposite, we plunge into our research in hopes of finding out how it did actually happen. In so doing, we find out this is why it happened. And why it happened in a very complex set of... Your caller instances one case. We could all instance and have started others. But the truth is somewhere in those details.
But this circles the larger question. Can one learn from and thus be guided in public in policy decision-making by history?
Well, clearly, as historians, we all hope so. Otherwise, I think we wouldn't be writing our books. The problem is even what the historian hopes people will learn from their stories isn't necessarily what the reader takes from it. So it can be a complicated issue. I think von Ranke, for example, certainly wrote his histories of great leaders in some ways to present as models for a growing middle class or aristocracy. And that isn't necessarily how they were read. So in multiple ways, I think it's complicated to assume that any history is going to teach us. The intention isn't necessarily what gets taught.
Well, I would say as someone who practiced for a while policy how to put it, attempted to influence policy either through the media or
you had some governmental connections,
and
didn't you?
Through governmental connections.
Yeah.
As historian, I would say the problem is the difference between knowledge and judgment. That history can provide the kind of knowledge that an informed judgment should have, the kind of knowledge that a good judgment should be based upon, should be informed by. But it's the judgment itself, the decision that is made, the judgment that's made, that makes the difference. Many politicians, and we can point to examples, have informed themselves more or less reasonably well in making a judgment. Often, Harry Truman insisted, for example, by reading history. Others have paid no attention. Henry Ford's view, history is bunk,
yeah.
and plunged ahead. I mean, you know, it's the judgment call that's important. We hope well informed.
And more generally, the fact that we all spend years, and often very, very dull years, immersing ourselves in a subject in order to be able to comment intelligently upon it, means that the lesson of history is very much in its complexity, rather than in simplifying it into easy to digest lessons.
Well, you are all particularist historians, as most historians are these days. The practitioners of grand history, like Bill McNeil, who taught for many years at the University of Chicago, and is still around, still writing books in retirement. His was the sweep of all of human history, though particularly, I suppose, Roman, European history, but he branched out. And he presumed that you could judge from the total historical record, you could judge present policy issues and make wiser choices.
Well, I mean, if I think about, say, the case I know best, France, I've spent a lot of time thinking about the separation of church and state that happened in 1905. This is something that was intended to solve France's religious problem. And at that time, that was an attempt to literally create a secular state and make religion a private matter. I think right now the French... French politicians have taken from that lesson that they can do the exact same thing to solve what they consider a current religious problem, which is how to assimilate their Muslim immigrants. I personally think that they have not learn the right lesson from history as they attempt to literally take a type of 1905 settlement, which may have made sense in the context of Catholic anti-clerical conflicts, and now have transformed them to a situation in which they are trying to assimilate a very different group, which are Muslim immigrants, through the same process.
What do you think they're doing wrong? How is it wrong?
Well, I understand the French desire to solve problems by simply saying that church and state, religion and state, are totally separate matters, and that religion must remain a private mm-hmm. matter. But in fact, the context of the 21st century is that religion is not merely a question of faith, it's also a question of culture. It always was, I would say, in many ways.
So coming down to particulars, you think they made a big mistake in ruling out headscarves in the Lycées of France?
I think that they are not going to solve their problem by outlawing headscarves in France.
That's not the crucial issue, I agree with you.
Right, I mean, but that in fact, they may even make the problem worse by doing it that way.
And a little comparative history, look at the United States, which has had separating of church and state, and it would be unthinkable in this country to try and rule out what school district, what principal, what college president would say, no headscarves, for heaven's sake.
Right, but I mean, the French context is important because they're not just ruling out headscarves. Yeah. It's any visible
crosses,
sign. Yeah. But of course, when you're a disenfranchised minority presence, it feels different.
Mm-hmm. We are late for some commercials. We'll take care of those and then right back to the phones. Some lines are available again if you've been trying to reach us. For a while, they were all taken, but some people have grown tired of waiting. So, 591-7200 is the number. If you move quickly, somebody will certainly get through. 591-7200 for email, which has infinite capacity. That's extension 720 at tribune.com. And it's time to reintroduce our guests. They are Suzanne Kaufman, who is professor of history at Loyola University, specializing in modern European history, especially the history of modern France. Her most recent book is, I wrote it down and I can't read it.
Consuming Visions, Mass Culture and the Lord's Shrine.
And that's published by Cornell University Press. Ethan Shagan is professor of history at Northwestern, specializes in politics and religion in the Reformation era of England. His most recent book is titled Popular Politics and the English Reformation. Do I have that right?
You do.
Cambridge University Press, 2003. And James Craycraft, is professor of history at the University of Illinois, Chicago, specializing in Russian history. His most recent book, The Petrine Revolution in Russian Culture, is published, or is it about? Yeah, it was published just recently by Harvard University Press, 2004. And this somewhat earlier book, written at the popular level, The Revolution of Peter the Great, also published by Harvard University Press. That's about 2 years ago, isn't it?
Oh, just a year ago, and it's short and sweet.
Yeah.
That's why I was pushing it.
All right. I'm happy to help you push
it. Well, short anyway.
We go back to the phones. 591-7200, you are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, good evening. I was interested in the discussion of Henry VIII. However, I was surprised that there was not more discussion of Elizabeth I, who actually established the Protestant Reformation and eventually led to the defeat of the Spanish Armada, which essentially made England sort of more of a safe place for Protestantism than the continent.
Well, we would agree with that simple characterization. We can't do everything in one radio program.
Yeah, that's right. I would say there's no question that Elizabeth's reign is tremendously important in the establishment and survival of Protestantism in England. Of course, it was also a period of some of the greatest dispute amongst Protestants in England over the religious future of the country. This Elizabethan period is the period when Puritanism, as a religious strain, developed for the first time. A group of Protestants who were extremely upset with the Queen and the government for not pushing the Reformation farther. And this was to become a sort of leitmotif of English history, this division into those who thought that the Elizabethan settlement of the church was itself a Reformation versus those who thought that it was only the beginning of one.
Isn't it true to say that the question survives in England and particularly in the Anglican Church and its Episcopal branch in this country, this tension or struggle between whether we're Protestant or not, whether we're Catholic or Protestant, high church, low church, broad
absolutely,
church.
Absolutely. In fact, there's an old joke that there are two great ways to start a fight in an Episcopal church. One is to stand up and say the Episcopal Church of America is a Catholic church, and the other is to stand up and say the Episcopal Church of America is a Protestant church. The reality is roughly half the people in any given congregation will feel either way.
Isn't it interesting to note that the Anglican Church, as represented by the Archbishop of Canterbury, has just told the American Anglican Church, that is, the Episcopalian Church, you're out of, you be quiet for the next few years. You're not going to be in the Lambeth Conference, which is the annual get-together of the bishops of the Anglican Church. And all of this having to do
With the gay bishop issue.
With the ordination of the gay bishop in New Hampshire. Right. And more broadly, the whole question of the disposition toward homosexual clergy.
Yeah, the decision that the Anglican Communion has made to temporarily exclude the American church is an odd sort of temporary expediency. It's very much in fitting with the Anglican Church's self-representation as a moderate middle way of a church, one which is always valuing the peace of the church more than it does particular dogma. The reality is, as Suzanne was saying about the religious issue in France, I think that this is not a way to end their problems. The idea that the issue is going to go away in the next 10 years, I think, is obviously sort of silly. One can only assume that there is a great deal of backroom negotiation going on, and that what's really behind this temporary hiatus is an attempt to not air the dirty laundry in public, but rather to do it in private.
Well, I think it's, again, this is the historian's view, that things are always more complex than they seem, that there are large segments of what is the Anglican Church now, and this represents a major change in the world, speaking of change, that are not in Europe or the United States or the English-speaking world, but in Africa and or Latin America or Asia, who see things very differently on this issue as among others. One could describe their views as more biblical or evangelical or fundamental or however you want to characterize them, but the fact is that the, by contrast, more liberal or urban or urbane or moderate churches of the U.S. and Canada in particular, England as well, are seen by this great majority of Anglicans in the world as errant.
So much comes back to religion one way or another when you examine the course of history regarding societies that we still know are societies that have essentially faded and declined.
Do you think it's religion or is it just values, values, real values?
Well, I was about to raise this question, which is a question that might bear historical elaboration or historical accounting. Why has religion so significantly declined in practice and in real faith in Western Europe, whereas it remains rather vigorous in this country?
Well, that is one question I have given a lot of thought to. I would say that we need to rethink how we even understand religion. I do think that official church practice has declined in Western Europe. People aren't going to church on Sunday. That doesn't mean people don't have a sense of the sacred or religiosity in their lives. That would be the first thing I would stress, that religion may be practiced, but not in the way, not in the church. But second, I do think, though, that there are some important differences between Western Europe and the United States. And I would argue that maybe the very fact that the United States has a long history of a disestablished church has allowed the United States to essentially led to the marketplace of religious ideas in this country that has allowed religion to nestle itself in to modern mass culture.
Somebody who's made that point for years, in fact, is Martin Marty, in his History of American, who's a great historian of American Christianity, but comparing it to European Christianity, he makes that very same point and was saying so years ago.
Yeah, no, the argument there is precisely that if you look at when different nations came into modernity, whether they had at that point an established church, what you find is that the more firmly the church as an institution is entrenched, the greater the level of secularism in the modern world, precisely because the impulse towards modernity was aimed so much at particular institutions.
Of course, in the country of your particular interest, Jim, there's been a great religious revival, hasn't there?
And it doesn't fulfill the recent generalization that was offered in that. Its church was established under Peter the Great as part of its modernization.
Yeah.
And its revolution took place in 1917 and thereafter, in large part against the established religion of the modernized Church of Peter the Great.
The great cathedral right on the Kremlin Square was made into a museum of atheism, as I remember it.
One certainly on Nevsky Prospect was made into the Museum of the History of Religion and Atheism, for sure. And all the churches, almost all the churches, were turned to secular purposes for one reason or another, and a vast secularization, a really vicious secularization under Lenin, Trotsky, and then Stalin, took place. And I once did a comparative study, much more vicious, much more vigorous than was done either in Mexico following its against the Roman Catholic, or in France in the French Revolution. Various reasons can be adduced for why that's the case, but I think the religious revival that you refer to in Russia today is, and this is the point I'd wish to make, the general point, is that when we speak of religion, often we're really talking about morality. Mm-hmm. And morality somehow has not historically, I challenge anyone to contradict me here, historically been able to exist or subsist for any length of time effectively in any given society without the support of religion and without being intermixed with part of religion and a religious message.
Well, that's a fascinating assertion. I think I agree with it as a sociological generalization.
What we often think in secular societies, like we sometimes think we are, that they can subsist, and in fact theoretical works are regularly produced on this subject, that morality can subsist, can exist, can function separate from, in defiance of, religion.
But you're saying empirically it doesn't quite work out that way?
No.
Yeah. 591-7200 is our number. If you want to get a call in, move quickly. We pause for a last round of commercial messages. And speaking of our audio archive, the two programs that have gone up most recently are, one, our recent program on Iran, and two, the future of the Catholic Church. The one on Iran focused particularly on the question of whether they are pursuing a program to develop nuclear weapons. That was the program that C-SPAN came to video and which was broadcast on television across the nation last weekend. Not the one just completed, but two weekends ago. Future of the Catholic Church, three strong lay Catholics with scholarly credentials as well, speculated on just what's happening within their church. Both of those, we thought, quite interesting discussions. That's why we've put them up on the audio archive. You get to that audio archive by going to WGNradio.com. If you click on my name, that takes you to the subsite for this program, and then just click on Audio Archive, and there you are. For those two programs, and for literally hundreds of others, either full programs or excerpts from other interesting programs that we've done over the long, really quite long haul. 591-7200 is the number. We go to the next caller. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. Pertinent to what you tried to do with the mnemonic device of Henry's wives,
yes,
is Billy Collins, who said the name of the author is the first to go, followed obediently by the title, the plot, the heartbreaking conclusion, the entire novel, which suddenly becomes one you have never read, never even heard of, etc., in his poem, Forgetfulness. And with regard to...
It shows up in songs, too, like the famous song, I'll Never Forget What's Her Name.
Right, and the story I heard last night about someone going to visit a professor at Northwestern, and someone locally said, well, who are you going to see? And he said, well, you know, I can't remember her name. It's kind of like a flower. And the guy says, a flower, a beautiful flower. And the man turns to his wife and says, Rose, what's the name of that guy? but I originally called because I had visited a website of one of your regular guests, and on it was a paper written about how the electric price in California was just a natural outcome of the way that the market works.
This is the time of the Enron scandal?
This is the time of the Enron, what's preceding the Enron scandal. It's what was the Enron scandal, indeed. Yeah. And there were papers that were quoting and justifying how this was true. And later on, we find that it's a scam, that there were people operating behind the scenes in a way that they didn't want us to know. And I think sometimes, too, of the way that the government classifies papers and what's going on and how do we figure out what really is going on.
That's what we historians try to do. I think I sense in your question, I'm one of the historians on the program here, I sense in your question a conspiracy theory of history or life. And that's
I don't think that that's what I had in mind, the conspiracy theory, but rather how facilely we can come up with theories.
All right. But I would... All right, you're not advocating a conspiracy theory or a concentric circles of conspiracies or little conspiracies and big conspiracies. I would say that there certainly are conspiracies, but that there's no one big conspiracy for sure. That there are conspiracies in the original sense, conspirators, people getting together and making deals, plans together, sure.
Well,
what's the surprise?
I sense, sir, that there's something you suspect to have happened that has not yet been acknowledged by historians or by journalists. What is that hidden truth?
I really hadn't thought about that, just how unhappy I was, and that a paper talking about it was still up on his current curricula. I guess that was more...
You mean, and events since, and media discovery since, and legal discovery since has falsified what is said in
the paper. Whose website are you talking about, by the way?
He's an economist who's on your show, but I'm a friend of his as well, so I'd rather not mention him by name. But if I could, one quick thing. You were talking about Jerusalem and Palestine, and there's a man named Jackie Comforti who has a film called The Optimists. It's about the Bulgarian treatment of the Jews. And at the beginning of World War II, there were 50,000 Bulgarian Jews. At the end of World War II, there were 50,000 Bulgarian Jews, that they were not sent to the concentration camp, that the Jews and the Muslims and the Christians had lived together for centuries in Bulgaria.
Sorry, I must interrupt you. Time is extremely short. If you have a point to make, do make it quickly, please.
Just that it's a wonderful story of how people can get together.
And we thank you for the call. Time literally is virtually out. There was one email that I thought, yes, here it is. We probably can't give it a good answer, but I like this as a question. I love history of all kinds, especially the exploration of the mysteries of history, such as how were the pyramids built, why did Hess fly to Britain? There are obviously many others. What mysteries do tonight's guests find interesting?
What mysteries do I find interesting?
And we only got 2 minutes.
That's a good question. I'm always interested in these conspiracies themselves. I wouldn't say a particular conspiracy that thrills me, but we were talking before about how it is that great men, or sometimes great women, supposedly make history. And the answer is, if they do, they do it in places where we as historians could never access it. They do it behind closed doors, chatting with their friends, hidden from view. And it's that whole sort of world of the back room that I find fascinating.
Do you love a mystery, Suzanne? And if so, which one?
I think if I didn't, I wouldn't have studied Lourdes. I'd say that for me, one of the things I'm interested in is how people make sense of the miraculous. And the miraculous is always... in many ways mysterious.
And what mystery still haunts you, James Craycraft?
No mysteries, but problems. A great historian once said study problems in preference to periods, and I've been formulating and thinking problems always. Just a different way of approaching it, I guess.
And with that, we come to the end of our revels. A few quick words, first to again tell you who our guests have been. James Craycraft of the History Department, University of Illinois, Chicago. Ethan Shagan, History at Northwestern. Suzanne Kaufman, History at Loyola University.